going to be hard to find a tighter package that in half an hour explains the terror of climate change and some of the solutions to it, as well as those who have fought against our understanding of this problem, namely ExxonMobil and other oil and coal companies. This is author and journalist Ross Gelbspan, the author of The Heat Is On, a book that I highly recommend. He's speaking on March the 20th, 2006 at a thing called Earthlands. Give Ross Gelbspan a listen here.
I have to tell you, I knew very little about Earthlands before I was invited here. It is a constant source of giving to the community. I mean, you have given so much to so many people by all the things you've hosted and facilitated. I think people who live in this town are very, very privileged to have you here. I also really thank John Seed very much. He is connecting lots of very primal dots that a lot of us seem to have forgotten in our rush toward what we call progress. So many thanks, John, for inviting me to be here as well. And thank you all very much for coming here, both for your interest and for coming in from this very nice spring evening to hear about this god-awful weather I'm going to talk about for a little while. So this is very appreciated. I just want to take a minute or two to tell you who I am and who I'm not. I'm a journalist and I'm not an environmentalist. I didn't get into this subject because I love the trees. I tolerate the trees. I got into the subject because I found out that the coal industry was paying some scientists under the table to say this isn't happening. And I said, there's this cover-up going on. What are they covering up? And there went the next 10 years of my life. So I just want you to understand that my engagement comes from a very different place from John's. The impulse that propelled me into this work really didn't come so much from a love of nature. It came from a very deeply held belief on which I predicated a 30-year career that in a democracy we need honest information to make decisions and then we will do whatever we do. And in this case, I found that some very powerful interests were stealing our reality, and I know in my bones and from all my experience, this is very, very bad for the democracy. It also turns out to be very, very bad for the planet. Unintentionally, we have set in motion massive systems of the planet with huge amounts of inertia that have kept this Earth hospitable for 10,000 years. We have heated the deep oceans, we have reversed the carbon cycle by 650,000 years, we have promoted a wave of violent weather, we've altered the timing of the seasons, we're living on an increasingly narrow margin of stability, and the evidence is all around us. Well, the world's governments, as you know, have spent 9 years to ratify emissions reductions of 6% and 7%, a larger reality is being ignored. The science is unambiguous. To allow the climate to stabilize requires cuts of 70%, and we have to do that if we are going to survive the coming era. And we have to do it very quickly. Last year, the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said we have a 10-year period to make very, very deep cuts in our use of coal and oil, quote, if humanity is to survive. That's not usually the kind of language that high officials use. That warning was echoed in December by NASA's Jim Hansen. The British ecologist James Lovelock was even more pessimistic a few months ago. He said that we have already passed the point of no return in our ability to stave off climate crisis. I'm not going to talk about the science, but the facts underneath the science are very simple. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until about 150 years ago when the world began to industrialize. That 280 is now up to 380. That is a level this planet has not experienced for 650,000 years. Unchecked, it will double to about 560 later in the century. That correlates with an increase in the average temperature of 4 to 10 degrees. And for context, the last ice age was only 5 to 9 degrees colder than our current climate. Each year, we're putting about 7 billion tons of carbon into an atmosphere whose upper extent is about 10 miles overhead. The most visible evidence of this newly unstable climate lies in a relentless succession of extreme weather events that have been increasing in frequency and intensity all over the world in the past couple of decades. I want to give you a couple of examples just from last year, 2005. In January, they had a 2-foot snowfall right outside Los Angeles. In February, there was a 125-mile-an-hour windstorm in Scandinavia. It forced the closing down of nuclear plants. Last summer, they had a very severe drought in the Missouri River that dropped its water levels to the lowest on record. In July, the worst drought on record in southern Europe triggered very extensive wildfires in Spain and Portugal. That same month, we had a lethal heat wave in Arizona that kept temperatures about 110 degrees for a week and killed 20 people. In August, the Indian city of Mumbai received 37 inches of rain in one day. It disrupted the lives of 20 million people. And of course, global warming hit the U.S. with a vengeance in the form of Katrina. And of course, 2005 surpassed 1998 as the hottest year on record. I want to talk separately from weather. I want to talk not about computer models, but I just want to run down a couple of actual physical changes that are taking place on the planet as we sit here. Warming expands water. Right now, officials are relocating 40,000 people from their island homes in the Pacific because those islands are going under from rising sea levels. Heat changes ecosystems. There were a couple of studies in the journal Nature in the last couple of years that found that insects, birds, fish, animals, and whole ecosystems all over the world are migrating toward the poles in search of stable temperatures. Warming is also accelerating in the deep oceans. They've measured it to a depth of 2 miles, which is extraordinary if you consider the inertia of the oceans. And in addition to fueling stronger hurricanes, that also is causing the breakup of big pieces of ice shelves. 3 pieces of Antarctic ice shelves bigger than the state of Rhode Island have broken off since 1995. And a little more than a year ago, the biggest ice shelf in the Arctic, which was 3,000 years old, 80 feet thick, and 150 miles in area, collapsed. The oceans are also becoming acidified from the fallout of our carbon fuel emissions. Scientists have determined that the pH level of the oceans has changed more in the last 100 years than it did in the previous 10,000. High above the oceans, most of the world's glaciers are retreating at accelerating rates. 20 years ago, the biggest glacier in the Andes Mountains was retreating by 14 feet a year. Today, it's retreating by 99 feet a year. The biggest glacier on the planet, which is the Greenland Ice Sheet, for the last decade, it was losing 3 cubic miles of ice a year. That's enough to cover the state of Maryland without a foot thick. And since then, the rate at which it's melting into the ocean has doubled. My daughter, whose work takes her frequently to Latin America, tells me now that in Ecuador and in Bolivia, people are abandoning entire villages because as the glacier melts, they have no more water to irrigate their crops. The tundra in Siberia and Alaska, which for thousands of years has absorbed methane and carbon dioxide, now is thawing and releasing those gases back into the atmosphere. Farmers in the Midwest have told me that the soil's drying out too quickly, the birds are laying their eggs at the wrong time, the plants are blooming out of whack, and that's because we've changed the timing of the seasons. Because of the buildup of CO2, spring now arrives more than 2 weeks earlier in the Northern Hemisphere than it did 20 years ago. And if you think about just that for a minute, what it means is we are changing the rhythm of nature by which we have lived our lives and planted our crops and written our poetry for 10,000 years. The last one of these physical impacts I want to talk about has to do with human health. Global warming is not good for us. The most obvious impact comes from heat alone. I'm sure many of you remember the 35,000 heat deaths in Europe 2 summers ago, and those heat deaths bear a very specific signature of human-induced global warming. One of the key findings of climate scientists is that as Earth's temperature rises, the nighttime low temperatures go up twice as fast as the daytime high temperatures. And that's because the carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases trap the heat in overnight. And what that means is that when a person's body becomes heat stressed during the daytime, they don't get the normal nighttime cooling to allow them to recuperate unless they have air conditioning, which is another whole issue. And that seems to have been what happened in Europe 2 years ago. Warming is also driving the spread of infectious disease. Warming accelerates the breeding rates and the biting rates of insects. It expands their range. It allows them to live at higher altitudes and higher latitudes. And so we're now seeing mosquitoes spread yellow fever and dengue and malaria to populations that have never before experienced it and have no natural immunity. Globally, malaria quadrupled between 1990 and 1995. So the impacts on our lives are truly profound. And as one world-class scientist said to me, if this unstable climate we're now beginning to see had begun 150 years ago, the planet would never have been able to support its current population. So for me, this sort of frames the drama. And it basically pits the ability of this planet to support civilization versus the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in history. The oil and coal industries together generate more than $1 trillion a year in commerce. They support the economies of more than a dozen nations, and in this battle, their resources are virtually without limit. For more than a decade, the fossil fuel lobby has mounted a very effective campaign of deception and disinformation designed to persuade the public and the press and policymakers that this issue is stuck in uncertainty. That campaign for the longest time attacked the science, and in so doing, it marginalized the findings of more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the UN in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. That same campaign has also misrepresented the economics of a switch to clean energy, telling us it will plunge us all into poverty. And now with its new champion in the White House, it's attempted to demolish the diplomatic foundations of the climate convention, and it has been extremely successful in maintaining a drumbeat of doubt in the public mind. Now, I want to give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about here. More than a decade ago, Western Fuels, which is a $400 million coal operation, it was very candid in its annual report. It said it was out to attack mainstream scientists. It hired three scientists who were skeptical of this phenomenon, Pat Michaels, Bob Balling, Fred Singer. It turned out they paid these three scientists more than $1 million under the table, which was never disclosed publicly until we wrote about it. Western Fuels and several coal utilities then launched a big PR program. They sent these scientists all over the country to do a lot of media interviews and lectures and appearances and so forth. We got a copy of the strategy papers for that campaign. And it says specifically the campaign is designed to reposition global warming as theory rather than fact. And more specifically, it was designed to target older, less educated men and young, low-income women in districts that get their electricity from coal and preferably have a congressman on the House Energy Committee. This is not subtle. They followed this with a $250,000 video that got very wide distribution. Somewhere in the middle, the argument changed. First time around, they said global warming's not happening. Next time around, they said it's good for us. And the argument that the video makes is, as we get more warming, we can grow more food in the far north and help feed an expanding population. Unfortunately, there were a couple of omissions from that video, including the fact that the soil up by the Arctic Circle is not very fertile. But the first one, as I mentioned before, is the bugs. Because of all the systems of nature, one of the most sensitive to temperature change is insects. And all the relevant scientists agree that as the temperature goes up, we will see a big increase in the population of crop-destroying and disease-spreading insects. There's another omission that I think is even more unconscionable, and that's this. As the temperature grows up and we get more CO2 in the atmosphere, it will temporarily accelerate crop growth in the northern hemisphere where we live. But that same increase will devastate crops in the tropical regions where most of the world's poor and hungry people live. Most of those crops are living at the optimum mix of heat and humidity. A half degree increase will cause a big drop off in the rice yields in Southeast Asia. It'll cause a 25% to 30% decline in the wheat yield of India. This is stuff the video doesn't mention. This manufactured denial is by far the biggest obstacle facing all of us working on this issue. This is the predictable outcome of this kind of campaign that was launched by the coal industry and carried forward most recently by ExxonMobil, which has spent more than $15 million between 1998 and 2004 bankrolling these skeptics and their institutions. We had a little fun with one of the most visible of these guys, Fred Singer. Fred declared in the Washington Post a few years back that he hadn't accepted any oil money for 20 years since he did some consulting for the industry. Whereupon, we wrote an article in The Nation saying he got at least $75,000 from ExxonMobil in 1998. And lest you think this was an ingenious feat of investigative reporting, it happened to be on ExxonMobil's website. Of course, they took down the page right after the article ran. But this is much more serious than a cheap thrill of gotcha journalism. In the early 90s, when the science was still uncertain, I think these kind of responses could have been expected as business as usual. But as the science has become so robust and the impact so visible, I really regard this as a crime against humanity. To me as a journalist, this campaign goes way beyond the normal reach of public relations spin. To me, what this represents is the privatization of truth. The skeptics have made a living by pointing out minor uncertainties in the science, but they've used uncertainty in a very selective and misleading way. Here's what I think the truth is about uncertainty. Carbon dioxide stays up there for 100 years. If we could magically stop all our coal and oil burning tomorrow, we would still be subject to a long spell of costly and traumatic weather extremes. Moreover, new research shows that prehistoric climate changes have happened not as gradual transitions, but as very abrupt shifts. A writer friend of mine, Diane Dumanosky, calls climate a leaping dragon. And the very small changes in a very delicately balanced ocean atmosphere system can produce very large outcomes. So not only are we gambling with our futures, we are gambling with our eyes blindfolded. We can't really read the cards we've been dealt. Here's some good news. Outside the U.S., there is virtually no debate in any other country in the world about what is happening in the climate. All the debate in the other countries is on the policy side. How do we change our energy systems without wrecking our economies, which is where I think the debate should be. And as examples of that, Holland is right now cutting her emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed Britain to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to cuts of 50% in 50 years. French President Chirac a few months ago called for cuts of 75% by the year 2050. So I think it's instructive to remember that the confusion about climate change stops at the boundaries of the United States. I also think it's very important to understand that climate change is no longer the exclusive franchise of environmentalists. Given its scope, this issue is becoming an action priority for groups like that focus on international relief and development like Oxfam, on campaign finance reform, because we're not going to get clean energy without clean elections, on public health, corporate accountability, labor, human rights, and environmental justice. There are aspects of this issue for every one of those constituencies. Let me speak for just a minute to the issue of justice. Climate change is nothing if not an issue of human rights. Secure shelter, food, and the tools for basic sustenance are embedded in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we are seeing them disrupted almost on a weekly basis by an increasingly unstable climate. Several years ago, Hurricane Mitch killed 11,000 people in Central America. No hurricane in the U.S. has ever taken that kind of toll. A couple of years ago, the worst flooding in memory left 500,000 people homeless in Sri Lanka. Rising sea levels are forcing the evacuation of whole island nations. Not long ago, the president of Tuvalu, a small chain of islands in the Pacific, called climate change a form of slow death. There is a connection between the impending evacuation of Tuvalu, compromised immune systems in Beijing, and rising levels of asthma in Roxbury. There is also a connection on the solution side. I think by blocking this transition to clean energy, big coal and big oil are withholding from the rest of us a huge surge in jobs and economic growth. At the corporate level, we have seen some voluntary progress. Ford and Daimler Chrysler have invested $1 billion to produce fuel cell powered cars. BP is now one of the world's biggest sellers of solar systems. Shell's created $1 billion subsidiary in renewables, but without a strong regime of mandatory government regulation, many of these initiatives will fail, and a number of oil company presidents have said this to me off the record. Without a binding structure of regulation to level the corporate playing field, ExxonMobil will undercut these initiatives with its artificially cheaper coal and oil. The solar and wind and hydrogen investments by BP and Shell and so forth will become money losers. And this continuing succession of droughts and storms and insurance losses and epidemics will tear holes in the global economic fabric. With that in mind, I want to briefly reference three sort of macro level kind of policies that form the centerpiece of the last chapter of this book, Boiling Point. I believe, in fact, that they if they're not right in detail, they represent an example of the general direction the world has to move. And they include a change in energy subsidy policies, they include the creation of a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries, and they also involve a regulatory mechanism that makes every country increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year. And before I go on, let me just tell you, there is no resistance to this from developing countries. The most air-polluted cities in the world are in China and Bangkok, Thailand, and Santiago, Chile, and Mexico City. They would love to go solar. They just can't afford it. Let me just run through these very briefly. On the subsidy front, the federal government spends between $25 and $30 billion every year subsidizing coal and oil. In the industrial world overall, that amounts to $200 billion in subsidies for fossil fuels. And what we're saying is take that money away from fossil fuels, put it behind renewables. The oil companies will follow the money. They'll begin to become aggressive developers of solar panels and windmills and fuel cells. But I also think it would bring out of the woodwork an army of energy engineers and entrepreneurs with better generations of solar film and turbines in an explosion of creativity that would rival the dot-com revolution of the 90s. The second element is the creation of this fund. It's been estimated at about $300 billion a year for a decade to allow clean energy infrastructures to take root in developing countries. You can fund this a number of ways. You can do it from carbon taxes in the north. A British cabinet minister proposed a tax on international airline travel. What we happen to like is a tax on international currency transactions. And today, the commerce in those transactions totals $1.5 trillion every day. And were we to tax them at the rate of a quarter of a penny on a dollar, that would net out to $300 billion a year for wind farms in India and solar assemblies in El Salvador and fuel cell factories in South Africa and vast hydrogen-producing farms on the deserts of the Middle East. Finally, the last element is this binding progressively fossil fuel efficiency standard that goes up 5% a year. What that means is that every country starts at its current baseline and it produces the same amount next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or it produces 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows at 5% for very long, emissions reductions outpace long-term economic growth. Actually, on the ground, it would happen much faster. What would happen is for the first few years, countries would meet this 5% just through efficiency, just by getting the waste out of their current energy systems. And when those efficiencies became more expensive, they would meet the 5% by bringing in renewable energy, most of which is 100% efficient by this standard. And that would begin to create the mass markets and economies of scale that would bring down their prices and make them economically competitive with coal and oil. Several oil company presidents have said in private they can do this. They can decarbonize their energy supplies, but they need the governments of the world to regulate them so they can all make this transition in lockstep as an industry without losing any market share to the competition. And I think this progressive efficiency standard is an example of that kind of regulation that could make it happen. What I'm talking about in terms of this global fund is not a traditional North-South giveaway. The fund represents the transfer of resources from the finance sector in the form of speculative, non-productive transactions into the industrial sector in the form of intensely productive, wealth-creating, job-generating resources. What I am talking about is a critical investment in our own national security. The global climate envelops all of us. I think what's needed is the kind of thinking that gave rise to the Marshall Plan after World War II, so that today, instead of a collection of dependent and impoverished allies in Europe, we have very robust trading partners. And we think a plan of this magnitude, regardless of what the details are, would have a similar effect on the world's developing countries. It would create millions and millions of jobs. It would raise living standards abroad without compromising ours. It would allow poor countries to grow, both without regard to atmospheric limits, and in many cases without the budgetary burden of imported oil. And in a very short time, it would jump the renewable energy industry into being a central driving engine of growth of the global economy. The real economic issue involved in this rewiring the world with clean energy is not cost. The real economic issue is whether the world has a large enough labor force to accomplish this task in time to meet nature's deadline. What I've been talking about here, and I'll stop soon, is an energy transition we could hopefully allow the climate to stabilize, but this ignores a lot of other areas of our rapidly deteriorating biosphere. Some of my environmental friends worry that a plan whose appeal is based on wealth and commerce could be the undoing of other planetary systems whose vitality is already at risk. My personal hunch is that changes in value frequently follow changes in technology. And I think if we were to really bring home the true proportions of the climate crisis to everyone, people would realize that we are living on a planet with limits and we're bumping up against those limits. Ultimately, I think this kind of a program would yield a lot more than a global fuel switch. I think it would lead in very short order to closed-loop industrial processes, to smart growth planning, to the adoption of environmental accounting in the way we calculate our wealth, and to a whole new ethic of sustainability that would transform our practices and institutions in ways we can't even begin to imagine. Back here on Earth, of course, the reality is a little different. The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political system with money. 5 years ago, the president reneged on his campaign promise to cap emissions from power plants. The administration then announced the first draft of its energy plan, calling for up to 1,900 new power plants, which is basically a fast track to climate hell. In a truly Orwellian stroke, the White House ordered the EPA to remove all references to the dangers of climate change from its website. Soon after taking office, the president appointed an official of the American Petroleum Institute to head up the White House's climate office. That official altered a major report about coming impacts in the U.S., and that was discovered, and he was forced to resign, and within a week later, he was given a job at ExxonMobil. This is not political conservatism. This is corruption disguised as conservatism. More recently, one of the country's most prominent climate scientists, Jim Hansen, learned he was being censored when the agency ordered him to get prior approval for any press interviews or papers or lectures. Shortly thereafter, it was disclosed that the agency that has most of the climate researchers, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that none of those researchers could take part in any press interviews without an agency minder sitting at the table to allow them what to say. This is very troubling to me as a journalist. The reason that I wrote these two books as hard as I did was because of what the scientists said to me off the record. On the record, scientists use very conservative language. They talk in terms of trends and estimates and probabilities. Off the record, they said this is scary as hell. And it gave me a kind of context and a perspective of understanding for writing these books. And that perspective I would have never gotten if there was a government minder sitting at my elbow. Finally, of course, the president withdrew the U.S. from the Kyoto process, and he said he did so because the treaty was unfair to the U.S. because it exempts the developing countries from the first round of cuts. At some point, the president might stumble across the fact that it was his father who approved the exemption of the developing countries in the first round, and for good reason. We in the North have created this problem. We in the North have the resources to begin to address it. We in the North need to take the first steps, and the rest of the world will come along. The real truth is, if we in the North don't get this right, we will suffer severe economic, social, political, and all kinds of damage, whether or not we impose energy restrictions on developing countries. As one Argentine climate negotiator said, we are all in the same boat, and there's no way half the boat is going to sink. But despite what's going on in Washington, political conditions have changed quite a bit in the last couple of years. A number of political conservatives are now embracing this issue. William F. Buckley has warned readers this is not an Al Gore issue. We really are producing too many greenhouse gases. A couple of years ago, Jim Woolsey, former head of the CIA, and Richard Lugar, who's a Republican senator from Indiana, had a very articulate article in Foreign Affairs magazine. Bush's first Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, has likened the coming impacts of climate change to a nuclear holocaust, and the person taking the lead in trying to regulate CO2 emissions in the Senate is conservative Senator John McCain. On the ground today, many activist groups are taking up climate as their central issue. Growing numbers of cities and states and universities are implementing their own on-the-ground emissions reduction plan, and the religious community is becoming involved in this in a very, very big way. So despite the current political situation, I really believe for a whole host of reasons that the time is right for a major offensive on this issue. We have as allies most of the nations of the world. We have growing numbers of corporations. Most importantly, we have nature. Climate change is only going to get worse. But the time for action is very, very short. As I mentioned before, the oceans are heating, the glaciers are melting, violent weather's increasing, the timing of the seasons is changing, and all that has happened from 1 degree of warming. And by contrast, we are now looking forward to a century of 4 to 10 degrees of warming. I think our civilization is standing at an extraordinary cross point. And while a positive prognosis may be too visionary, the alternative, given the escalating instability of the climate and the increasing desperation of poverty, is really horrible to contemplate. Our recent history has been marked by the totalitarianism of command and control economies and the opulence and brutality of unregulated markets and runaway globalization. I think it's just possible that this kind of a public works program to rewire the planet could serve as a little pilot, a little model toward where I think we really want to go, and that is toward that optimal calibration of competition and cooperation that would maximize our energy and creativity and productivity, and at the same time dramatically expand the baseline conditions for peace, peace among people and peace between people and nature. So thank you all so much for your attention. I really appreciate it.
You have been listening to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ross Gelbspan. He's the author of 2 books on climate change. One is called Boiling Point, which was read by President Clinton, and the other is The Heat Is On, which was reviewed by Al Gore in the Sunday New York Times Book Review. Find out more about Ross Gelbspan by going to his website at www.heatisonline.org. Heatisonline.org.